equal in the matter of rights and responsibilities, and he did not fix any limit in this behalf of equality among all human beings. And if he did fix any such limits, it was fixed keeping in mind the interests of the public in general, the people. And when we study the character of Imam Ali, we clearly see that he did not violate this freedom, the freedom of the people, the freedom of the public, the freedom in any of his laws, orders, rules, or regulations, and he always kept the public welfare in his view, in all his actions. He dealt equal treatment to both his friends and his foes.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: هلك في رجلان، محب غال ومبغض قال.
أمير المؤمنين Ali alayhi salam said, "Two categories of persons will face ruin on account of me: he who loves me with exaggeration, and he who hates me intensely."
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is To My Brother, and we're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So, dear friends, we are talking humbly about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, the first divinely appointed Imam and the rightful successor to the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Of course, many scholars throughout the ages have written incredibly beautiful things in the praise of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And these scholars are not always Muslim scholars, meaning that there have been many non-Muslim scholars who have also praised Imam Ali alayhi salam and his amazing universal persona. One of the things that we see in this universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this suppression of anger. Right, so we do not see in the history books that Imam Ali alayhi salam became angry, randomly. Yes, there is a difference between courage and anger. There is a difference between a positive anger, which leads to courage, and a negative anger, which is a vice and it is a bad quality. So here, you know, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he suppressed his anger if he ever got angry, which is a different discussion, you know. But here we find that even the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, advised Imam Ali alayhi salam some general commandments. And of course, you know, these general commandments are applicable to every single one of us. And one of those things was to suppress anger. And so Imam Ali alayhi salam, not only was he able to suppress and control this anger, this power of anger, but he was able to do so especially when he had the capability or the ability, or let's say the opportunity, to punish the other person. So the very famous example that is constantly spoken about is, you know, in one of the great battles of Islam, Imam Ali alayhi salam was on the chest of the opponent, and the opponent, he disrespected Imam Ali alayhi salam by spitting on his face. So Imam Ali alayhi salam, he suppressed his anger, he got off the chest, and he walked around, and he came back, and then he slew the enemy. So here, you know, this suppression of anger is something that is really important. Now, what's interesting is that when an individual has the ability to punish the other person, so, you know, you are able to punish another individual who is at a lower, I guess, status than you are. So a father can punish a child, a teacher can punish a student, and, you know, a grandparent can punish a grandchild, a boss can punish their workers, subordinates, and so on and so forth. So this individual who's able to punish is in a position of power. Now, in a position of power, it has been, you know, dictated to us believers that when you are able to punish, you should suppress your anger. And that if an individual is able to suppress their anger, when they have the opportunity to punish this person who is under them, that the Almighty Allah will endow them with security and a tasteful, beautiful, delicious faith on the day of resurrection. That's how important suppressing our anger when we are able to punish is. A very beautiful lesson indeed, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Aminullah along with its English translations. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma fastajib du'ayi waqbal thanayi wajma' bayni wa bayna awliyayi bihaqq Muhammad.
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master, and my Lord. Welcome, my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the fully, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
Has a verse ever come where Allah says, woe to you for running away from the battlefield? Woe to you for lying. Woe to you for raising your voice in front of the messenger. Woe to you for being disrespectful to the prophet. Has the Quran ever said that? If it is not, and there are those who have held power, who have held the previous latter points that I mentioned, Allah on judgment day will question the integrity of my soul and say, you accepted that? You think I will send representatives like this? I asked my Christian brethren the same question. Paul persecuted Christians. He killed them. It's not a historical bleep, it's known. I say to them, as much as great as a man you consider him to be, can God send a messenger, a representative who's going to be the central axis of your faith from the very direction of the person who was against God? They said, well, that's how the pendulum swings. I said, if that's the case, then let's make the devil the most important man. For if he became a believer today, he would be the most powerful man because his pendulum swung the most. Absurd, isn't it? It's absurd, brothers and sisters. Even you and I, as much as a person lied to you and me, wants to go into business with me, I'll never trust that person. Even if that person gives everything of his life in front of me, I'll never trust him 100%. Why? He's a human being. We all make mistakes. We have a right to forgiveness. And we do forgive. And we have forgiven. But would you and I go into transaction at that level, knowing that this person cheated me before, and now he has asked for forgiveness, but it's okay, take everything that I own? You and I would never do this. How would you and I do this without religion? At the end of the day, civil law is never as important as moral law. So I conclude at this level, that when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has commanded Imam Ali, why is Allah saying, Al-yawma akmaltu lakum dinakum? This verse in Surah Al-Ma'idah, verse number 3, which was revealed. Why was it revealed? And it's revealed in between verses about food. Allah uses as what we call parenthetical. Parenthetical meaning it is so important. It comes between something that you're questioning. Why is this verse here? Just like the ayah of the Tahir of Ahlul Bayt, you find it's in between the rebuking of wives of the Prophet of Allah. You say, why is it here? Allah says it's parenthetical. Use your mind, understand the principles of who this messenger was, who he chose, what he pointed to, what the world has to say, and then go down to the essence of who you are and ask the question, who is most worthy of being the best representatives of Allah, and then follow that part, because on Judgment Day, you will never be held liable for that. So you find Allah after Imam Ali alayhi salam has been appointed, you find that Allah reveals this verse, Al-yawma akmaltu lakum dinakum wa atmamtu alaykum ni'mati wa raditu lakum al-islam deena. Wow, today we have completed our favor. It's a momentous moment, brothers and sisters. Tonight, we celebrate this for this reason. What is it about? Is it the quantity? It's the quality. The quality is sealed. It's complete. Why does Allah say, Ya ayyuhar rasul balligh ma unzila ilayka min rabbik? The last part Allah says what? Wallahu ya'asimuka. God will protect you from mankind, because Shaitan and his group know, bring the religion of God, bring it halfway, we'll fill in the gaps. We're more than happy to do that. We love when God brings a religion. He gives us a springboard to put ourselves in position. Then no one will reject us. Yesterday I was watching on television, there's this called some ministry that's been robbing people of millions, $450 million theft. The guys are standing there, robbing everybody in the name of God. The Spirit of God is with you. Have faith. The guys are giving thousands, millions of dollars. Have faith. The guys are robbing them, running. Running away. Have faith. And I'm listening. I said, wow, there it is. There it is. Allah says, look, blind faith, look where it takes you. You want that? You have crooks who come and rob you left, right, and center. Is that how you do it? No. It's found on good grounds, on a basis that when you look at it, you say, this has merit.
For listening to this episode of the program To My Brother. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Thank you. visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Try and try again could be the slogan of the Western Hegemonic Front, with its goal of attempting to pressure and overthrow the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, the latest move is the initiation of the snapback mechanism of the JCPOA against Iran by the three European signatories of the deal. Preventing Iran's progress and weakening the country have been the goals of several Western countries since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. But what does it mean this time around? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this Spotlight.
At midnight on Sunday, what Europeans claim to be the reinstatement of UN sanctions on Iran came into effect. The European trio, namely Britain, France, and Germany, initiated the process last month by activating the snapback mechanism of the 2015 nuclear deal, claiming that Tehran had failed to uphold its nuclear commitments. But Iran argues the opposite, that it was the Europeans themselves who violated the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, which was endorsed by UN Security Council Resolution 2231. In a statement released by Iran's foreign ministry, Tehran has rejected the snapback as both illegal and unjustified.
Iran's foreign ministry considers the actions of the European Three and the United States in misusing the JCPOA and UN Security Council Resolution 2231 as illegal and unjustified. It stresses that restrictions under that resolution must end by October 18, 2025. The ministry says the E3, under U.S. pressure, triggered the snapback despite failing to meet JCPOA commitments. Iran adds that over for years it offered proposals for full implementation of the nuclear deal or a new understanding, but all failed due to the lack of good faith by the E3 and the U.S.
Iran's parliament speaker, Mohammad Bagheer Ghalibaf, has also warned that any country taking action based on these illegal UN resolutions will face consequences.
The Islamic Republic of Iran considers the restoration of the UN sanctions as illegal. If any country wants to take action against Iran based on these illegal resolutions, it will face serious reciprocal action from Iran.
Russia and China have also issued a joint statement rejecting the snapback as illegitimate.
The two countries said the reinstatement of UN sanctions against the Islamic Republic is illegal and invalid. Moscow and Beijing said they will not comply with or abide by the new sanctions. They also vowed to continue their business dealings with Tehran as usual regardless of the embargoes.
Despite years of broken promises, Tehran says the door to diplomacy remains open, but many Iranians remain skeptical, doubting that engagement with the West can yield real benefits.
Negotiations are useless. We were busy with the negotiations when they attacked. They are not trustworthy at all. The deals you make with them, their negotiations, none of them can be relied on.
And as sanctions return, the stakes extend far beyond Iran. Analysts warn that the credibility of the UN Security Council itself is on the line, sanctioning a country that remains a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, while failing in the same month to adopt a ceasefire resolution on Gaza under relentless attack by a nuclear-armed regime. A stark reminder that the world's highest body for peace and security faces an unprecedented crisis of legitimacy.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. sub-chef, author, and commentator out of Belfast. And Syed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London. Welcome both of you to the program. Let's start this off in Belfast with Saab. I mean, Saab, the snapback mechanism or the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231 says that Iran should not undertake any activity concerning its ballistic missiles. No test, no development. Why would Iran abide by such a resolution, especially after just experiencing all of NATO and Israel waging war against it?
Hello to you and to your guests and audience. We know the snapback mechanism are included within the nuclear agreement framework, and that allows certain UN sanctions to be reimposed if Iran proved was non-compliant. This non-compliance should be presented to the by JCPOA partner. Here, let's see even the EU Troika, which is two of it, the French and the British in the Security Council, they are not part of the JCPOA anymore, since they demanded what Trump wanted them to extract from Iran at the time, to get zero enrichment of uranium. That flies in the face of the 2015 JCPOA, which has permitted Iran to enrich uranium I think, the 3.75%. And while Iran, as signatory to the NPT, should enjoy the enrichment rights and protection of its nuclear sites, we've seen when the U.S. and the Zionist entity attacked Iran while engaging the Americans with Iran in six rounds of negotiation. And they cheated, and the United States of America attacked the Troika here, the EU. They didn't even condemn these attacks on Iran. Moreover, they were demanding Iran to allow Grossi and his team to inspect. Grossi, who we know is responsible for many death is among Iranian scientists, since the list of Iranian scientists were found, the Zionist entity have, who give it to them, God knows. And at the same time, we understand as well, after that in Cairo and Istanbul, is in Cairo one, there was agreed an IAEA kind of agreement, which Grossi said they finalized all the issues, and his team is going to Tehran. What happened then is Trump decided to ignore all the international norms again, as he did in 2018, and to impose, he tried to impose his will in the United States of America on Iran, to deny it its own civil nuclear program, to dismantle it in totally. This is what the Americans want, since this is what Netanyahu wants.
Okay. All right. Well, Syed Mohsen, I mean, your perspective about the snapback, and let's start a little bit before that. In your opinion, did Iran gain anything by signing the JCPOA?
Nothing. The Americans never, ever lifted sanctions. The Europeans never lifted sanctions. In fact, the Americans under Trump, of course, went into an even heavier set of full-spectrum sanctions and have been continuing to increase those incrementally since they pulled out. And they walked out of this JCPOA agreement, which made it effectively defunct and dead from that point. The reality is that I think Iran has been trying to offset at least the full set of sanctions which the UN had imposed, which I think mean there's a greater pressure on military arsenal and equipment, etc., and it makes it a little bit more difficult, but not that much more. The full set sanctions that Trump has overseen during his two terms so far have meant that Iran are completely hemmed in by those sanctions, and they've only been able to, I guess, keep a lifeline going with, one, the resistance economy itself, two, the support of the Iranian public, and, of course, three, China and the likes of Russia, who've still been able to do deals and are beginning to do more deals without the use of the dollar. And of course, Russia has just signed a huge $25 billion contract with Iran, just as China had done before it. So there is still that hope that the lifeline that the Eurasian Axis gives Iran could allow it to weather these sanctions and these terrorist acts. They're acts of economic terrorism. This is what Trump is doing. This is what the Europeans are doing, because it's part of a full-spectrum attack on Iran, both using, they'll use cyber web technology, they will use grassroots insurgencies, they will use terrorists within Iran, as they did during the 12-day war recently. They will use insurgencies from outside Iran. Some of the groups that are lined up on the borders of Iran are also preparing for attacks, no doubt. Israel itself has got the bit between its teeth. It thinks that this kind of triumphalism that they've whipped up amongst the Western Zionists, that somehow they can destroy Iran through forever war and through the latest 12-day war which they painted as a victory for themselves, saying that they weakened the defense mechanisms of Iran and they can finish the job in another track. It's quite delusional, I think. And of course, that delusion you can't change, because the establishments here in the West, this Troika, America, they're basically Zionists. They're absolutely infiltrated by Zionists, and the Zionists control the foreign policies of Britain, the West, and generally, of course, America.
Right, right. Well, what do you make of the UN Security Council's vote on not to delay for six more months of implementing the snapback sanctions while talks take place?
It's exactly as my friend Sayed was saying, and the president of Iran, when he said, Bazrgan, the Americans want us to hand over all our enriched uranium, and in return they give us only 3 months. This is unacceptable, as he said. Where is the denial of the 6 months by United Nations Security Council? The America want to start to impose heavy blows at Iran, but we can understand the Iranian economy when Bazrgan himself, he said, if we have to choose between America's illogical demands and the snapback mechanism, our choice as Iranian will be the snapback mechanism. A prospect of economic impact by this reimposing UN sanctions will be driven merely by psychological responses, that rather than by immediate and concrete economical impact. The UN Security Council resolution holds little or even insignificant kind of effect compared to what my friend was alluding to, the U.S. sanctions imposed by Trump and his Western allies after he abandoned himself in 2018, the JCPOA, with a tweet showing insult to the international community. We have to understand here that the snapback primary targets a dual-use nuclear and missile-related kind of activities, and it does not plainly reimpose widespread economic sanctions on oil exports or banking or trade. Most of these sectors already been sanctioned before by the U.S. and the Europeans. From 2017, even before that, as well Sayed said, they never lifted their sanction. In reality, that makes the impact of the snapback mechanism less severe, and to a lot of people, what they expecting is going to affect the economic sectors. It's only fears that will. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, Sayed Mohsen, I mean, let's talk about the overall hypocrisy of this. I mean, while the Zionist regime continues with his genocide and the use of illegal weapons in Gaza and have possession of nuclear weapons, the so-called international community does nothing to the regime but focuses on Iran, which has regularly been involved in negotiations over its peaceful nuclear program and has abided by its commitments.
Israel is not affected or a member of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. That's a crime, an absolute global crime. Israel has nuclear weapons, up to 400 at the least, from our understanding, and of course has been exposed for that by the Times in England long ago. Vanunu and all of that revelation was clear to the whole world. Yet here we have a United Nations and a world, UNGA, basically ignoring Israel and its threat to the entire region and indeed the entire world with this arsenal of nuclear weapons, which goes uninspected, unregulated, unchecked, and unacknowledged. And the reason the Americans don't acknowledge it is because the minute they acknowledge that the Israelis actually have weapons formally, that would mean that the AIEA would be officially obliged to then rein Israel in. And of course, they would also have to join the non-proliferation treaty. So there's this rather pathetic, hypocritical game which the Americans have got going, which the whole world knows about, and yet can't seem to do anything about it. This is what bothers me about the current international structures, that they seem to quickly impose sanctions on Russia and Iran. They can quickly impose all sorts of other sanctions on governments that they, the Americans, dictate to them need to be, if you like, punished. Yet when it comes to Israel, there's absolutely nothing that can be done. However, one word of hope is that the Colombian leader just recently has begun to trigger a mechanism within the UN, which will hopefully try to at least bring Israel to book through the right. possibility of a vote amongst the general UN body to actually trigger some sort of military intervention inside Palestine and Gaza. Right. That doesn't stop their attacks on Iran. It is really just these hawks who think they can engineer regime change inside Iran. They're absolutely hell-bent. They're desperate. They think that's their last chance. Because what will happen is, even if they do that, Marzia, what will happen in Iran? You'll get more power going to the IRGC. They'll have to step in and take even more control, which is against whatever these Zionists want. And the convulsive changes that might take place in their dreams would simply mean the nation would slide into an even more anti-US imperialism state. So they're going to
indeed. Stay with me, Saad Mohsen. Stay with me. Sorry to interrupt you. But, Saad, I mean, it was the United States which originally left the JCPOA and pressured the Europeans not to abide by it. But at the same time, it's Tehran that is being hit with more sanctions. I mean, doesn't this just highlight the level of hypocrisy of this so-called international rules-based system?
We understand that the hypocrisy exists before even the nuclear JCPOA program. It started with Iran from 1979 with the Iranian Revolution, since the United States of America deployed after the coup on Mossadegh in 1953, Shah of Iran, to be the policeman of the region and to loot the wealth of Iran, denying the Iranian people their own wealth, and to export that was to the British and then to the Americans. But since the Iranian Revolution, America is doing its best with all the Western alliance to collapse Iran, not even to reach the stage of regime change, to divide Iran to multi-ethnic kind of entities. So divide and conquer, divide and rule, easier to control and suck the wealth. Since the Iranian resilience stemmed from the revolution, and after, even amid sanctions, they were evolving and developing their educational and scientific, industrial and commercial capabilities, which is translated to a strong, diverse, developed industry and sectors of scientific or industrial sectors. Iran become from renter economy to non-renter economy. It depends on diverse kind of industries, agriculture, commerce, and innovative industries, which make it vital for the region and the global industry, global economy. So Iran, with that kind of links to global trade blocks, which we see in Asia or in the BRICS or in the make a lot of countries And a lot of these multilateral trade blocs look at Iran with genius kind of global, geopolitical position needed by the region, needed by India, needed by Pakistan, needed by Russia, needed by China. And this is hence we hear the message from the Chinese and the Russian and the United Nations when they said this is illegal sanctions.
Okay.
And
stay with me on that, because I want to pick up right there with Syed Mohsen about the illegality of what Russia and China, they are saying about the snapback mechanism. Let's talk about the role you see Russia and China playing in helping Iran offset this, and also the realization perhaps by Moscow and Beijing that what is happening to Iran could also happen to them, that would make them even more adamant about supporting Iran in this.
Russia and China are very well aware that, in a way, China is next, but Russia is already on the rack. The Americans have basically initiated the war in Ukraine, whatever they want, cover they want to put on it. They're the ones who encroached on Russian territory. So the Russians are already under sanctions, nearly as many as Iran. They've under attack directly through Ukraine and the war they've opened up there. They have also, been sanctioned so that their economies and the de-dollarization processes and the BRICS process and the Eurasian Axis process is broken. America is trying to cut off all trade routes that the Russians are trying to build up. So it's in the Russians' interest to create even more stronger alliances with Iran. And with this big deal, one hopes that the $25 billion deal is another rapid step to that. The cooperation between Russia and Iran in terms of technology, in terms of satellites, in terms of creating alternatives to anything that relies on America is absolutely vital. And I think that Eurasian Axis needs to develop these systems and alternatives even more rapidly. And the reality is that a dying American imperial empire, of course, is collapsing from within. You can see the civil crisis within America. You can see the civil crisis within Israel. So this is a race against time, even from them. Powerful as they are, the fact is there are fault lines and cracks appearing in the empire. And Iran, they need to, of course, destroy Iran as quickly as possible, and the Chinese ideally as well, if they can. That's in their heads, that they need to do that militarily is definitely on the agenda. And to suck the world into a global war where the economy collapses is also seems to be very much on their agenda, because they have no other thing in their minds other than dominance. So I think that now for Iran, they need to double down. And I think that needs to also recognize something deeper. One thing is that Imam Khomeini gave Iran a vision. He gave them a dream. He gave them a prophetic dream, and he revived that prophetic dream, which has a cultural and a spiritual and a social base to it, which is actually anathema to the Western neoliberal transhumanist dream. Because there is a dream that the transhumanist West, Zionist West, is pushing. These wars in Gaza, the war on Iran, is part of that. And of course, the Iranian people must and do, I think, recognize that traditional culture, family, spirituality, community, those old school values, the prophetic values, this is what is also under attack. They also fear Iran can come up with an alternative, one which isn't relying on the Chinese top-down, totalitarianly heavy surveillance capitalism, and it isn't also the same kind of transhumanist surveillance capitalism, totalitarianism, which is now rising in the West. Iran represents a civilization and a culture and a religious base which can give the world an alternative vision. And that's as much of a reason why it must survive, it must maintain its direction. It shouldn't sell out to the neoliberal enticement, which the likes of the Qataris and the Saudis have long since done, and sold out their values and sold out their people, because all this is going to lead to is enslavement of people in a new digital...
Okay, and on that note, Syed Mohsen, sorry to interrupt you, but we're out of time. Appreciate both of you being with me. Saab Shaf, author and commentator out of Belfast. Syed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. I wish that somehow you tell me out aloud that on that day I'll be okay. But we'll never know, 'cause that's not the way. Show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
Good day to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio, and I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Then it's time for Around the World with Reporters. Listen to fascinating reports from all over the globe as reporters tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. Our radio productions feature will again follow after this. Stay with us for this hour.
And finally, just to have a quick look at the map of Syria itself, we can see that the area in question to the south, so you have Sweda in the white circle, and then obviously extending up towards Damascus and Jerimana, and how the corridor itself would basically link Israel to the far northeast, covering the borders of Jordan and Iraq.
Israel's also considering the Euphrates River as a dependable water source for its occupied territories in a forward-looking perspective. A proposal to connect southern Syria to the Kurdish areas and construct a canal for transporting water from the Euphrates River to the Golan Heights is being contemplated as part of the concept of establishing David's Corridor by the Zionists. In recent years, the new
West Asia
has seen a rise in competition among various corridors, and Israel has put forth several trade and security corridor ideas with this competitive landscape. One of these ideas is a plan for a corridor known as David's Corridor, which aims to connect the Kurdish regions of Iraq and Syria, and then the Druze regions of Syria to Israel. The Druze majority areas of southern Syria, in particular in Reef Damask and Soweto province, are considered by the Israeli regime to be the closest areas to the interior of Syria in terms of security, with the potential for long-term investment in the implementation of these plans and programs.
There have been moves recently when there were clashes between the Druze factions in Jarumana, which is to the southeast of Damascus, that Israel would intervene to protect the Druze, and the Druze have become sort of a protected minority in Syria by Israel. You will notice that HTS are not going near the Druze, they are protecting them. Of course, they don't really care about the Druze. They just see the Druze as a means to actually advance closer to Damascus.
The Druze, a religious minority that separated from the Ismailis in the 5th century, have a rich history of presence in the Levant, especially in the southern regions of present-day Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine, spanning over 1,000 years.
I mean, you have the leadership being managed by NATO and the United States doing all they can to try to tamp down on these sectarian tensions. But then you have their followers, their goon squads, literal death squads that ravaged Syria for years, rampaged into religious minority communities, slaughtering people, forcing them to start their own militias. And they're on the loose now.
Their significant role in the emergence of modern Syria, conflicts with the French government for Syrian independence, and contributions to Arab nationalism in the early 20th century have cemented the Druze's position on the Syrian political scene, with figures like Sultan Pasha al-Atrash holding strong historical significance in Syrian nationalism. But why are the Zionists currently in a hurry to establish such a corridor and in this process have initiated a new occupation, massacred the people of southern Syria, suppressed their protests, and attempted to fuel ethnic tensions?
Which is basically a channel up the eastern border of Syria, linking with the Kurdish separatists in the northeast under the control of the US, but also acting as a settler proxy for Israel in that area, close to the east of the Euphrates, and eventually to link up with the Euphrates in Iraq. This is the Greater Israel Plan, and this is what Israel is basically working towards right now.
In the coming years, the world will witness significant changes in the trade routes connecting the East and the West. There's fierce competition among various well-known corridor plans that have been mentioned many times in the media. The most famous of them is the One Belt, One Road initiative, often referred to as the Silk Road of the New Era, proposed by China, which aims to connect Chinese soil with Iran, the Middle East, and ultimately the European market. But which countries will be involved in this connection? Could Syria, with its extensive history, once again serve as a transit highway and a passage corridor between the East and the West? Ever since Benjamin Netanyahu proposed the India-Israel Corridor Plan at the United Nations, which aims to pass through the Persian Gulf Arab states and eventually connect to European territory through the occupied territories. Experts have considered it as the main competitor to China's New Silk Road, which follows a similar corridor through China, Iran, Turkey, and Europe. Given there's greater likelihood of China's New Silk Road plan being implemented compared to the New Delhi-Tel Aviv corridor plan, the Zionists consider David's corridor as a suitable disruptor against the China-Europe corridor, a plan aiming to directly challenge the interests, integrity, and stability of Iran, Iraq, and Syria. Despite their apparent support for the new Syrian government and their recognition of it as an important member of the Arab League, most of the Persian Gulf countries are not likely to be upset about the weakening of Syria through the implementation of David's corridor and the decline in the importance of the Silk Road route in favor of the India-Israel corridor. The development and progress of the southern Persian Gulf countries have historically been impacted by the instability, war, and insecurity in the northern Persian Gulf countries over the past century, and as a result, they will strive to prevent countries like Iraq and Syria from becoming a hub for connecting major trade routes between China and Europe. If Syria achieves complete political stability and preserves its territorial integrity, it has the potential to once again become an important transit route in the China-Europe corridor, just as it did in ancient times. A road and rail route passing through Iran and Iraq that is connected to several highways and railways in Syria and has the potential to connect to European soil through two possible routes. The first route involves passing from east to west Syria, reaching the ports of Latakia, Tartus, and Banias, and then using the sea trade route to southern Europe. The second involves reviving the railway line from south to north Syria, similar to the famous Hejaz Railway during the Ottoman Empire, which would connect the trade route to Turkey and then Eastern Europe. Implementing such a plan could bring significant economic benefits to the Syrian people, help maintain the country's integrity, and enable Syria to rejoin the international community as a stable country, free from insecurity and chaos. However, the Zionist regime is actively working against Syria's interests in the transformation of the country into a transit highway on the east-west trade route of the world by planning to create a separatist corridor. Although the heroic people of Syria, after enduring 14 years of civil war, are still expressing dissatisfaction with the new government in Damascus, and have refrained from openly opposing the new Jolani government in order to maintain relative peace and prevent further conflict, they have courageously confronted the new Zionist invasion and occupation in Kenitra, Dara, and Rif Dimashq from the outset, and despite the silence and inaction of the current Syrian government, the people have actively resisted the Zionist enemy, thwarting their dangerous attempts to divide Syria and establish the David's Corridor. Numerous Syrian youth have tragically lost their lives or sustained injuries in protests against the establishment of Israeli military bases in southern Syria. Given that the fall of Bashar al-Assad and the rise of the coalition led by Tahrir al-Sham are viewed by many as a resurgence of Sunnis in power in Syria, the Israeli regime has sought to exploit identity divisions within the country, particularly among the Druze, Christian, and Alawite religious minorities in its endeavors to further its interests. In the midst of these conflicts, Israel not only announced its support for the Druze forces fighting the new government in Damascus, but also carried out significant bombardments of military positions in Syria, highlighting its intention to exploit the socio-political divide in the country. currently, despite the presence of the Jolani security forces in the Druze areas south of Damascus, in agreement with the Sueda Druze, which includes the selection of the province's security forces from local residents and the retention of weapons by the Druze armed groups, has resulted in the acknowledgement of Sueda province's relative autonomy in future political landscape of post-Assad Syria. A situation that also provides Israel with the potential to utilize it for future destabilization of Syria.
Attacks on the Kurds, as we saw yesterday in Manbij, must be stopped. It's a commitment of the international community towards those who fought bravely against ISIS. It's also a commitment for the future of Syria.
Taking a geopolitical perspective on Syria's eastern neighbors brings to light the significant economic and energy aspects of the David's Corridor project. Israel is seeking to exploit the differences between the Kurdish and Druze minorities and the Arab, Turkish, and Persian majorities in Syria, Iraq, Turkey, and Iran to incite confrontations between the minorities and the surrounding majorities. The Kurds and Druze hold deep historical roots in the region, while Israel is perceived as an externally introduced entity that does not align with the ethnic and geographical makeup of the area. Should the Kurdish and Druze minorities align with Israel and synchronize their interests, they'll likely be drawn into conflicts with regional governments and ethnic majorities, resulting in detrimental long-term consequences and bloodshed that would not serve the best interests of the Kurdish or Druze communities. The Kurdistan region of Iraq, an autonomous region, possesses significant oil and gas reserves as well as ample water resources, providing potential leverage over the central government of Iraq and neighboring countries like Iran and Turkey. This strategic location has long been viewed as a potential tool for political maneuvering by Israel to exert influence and pressure on major Middle Eastern states. The lack of national unity and cohesive ties within Iraqi society, combined with the central government, has historically created opportunities for external influence, in particular from Israel, and the prospect of Kurdish autonomy or independence has been perceived as a threat to Iraq's territorial integrity and a potential security risk extending even to the western borders of Iran. Despite some analysts expressing optimism about the future of Syria and its unity, the current tense situation and the potential future events raise serious doubts about the country's prospects. The tragic incident of March 2025 in the western coastal region of Syria, predominantly inhabited by the Alawites, which resulted in loss of hundreds of Syrian lives, highlighted the ongoing instability that still persists in the country. The violence was sparked by alleged attacks from armed groups loyal to the former Syrian government on security forces associated with Jolani, leading to a devastating loss of life among civilians, and if this trend persists, it could potentially be exploited by foreign actors, in particular Israel, for their own strategic interests.
So they funded the jihadists everywhere. Exactly. And by the way, it's not even, we made Al-Qaeda, I think everyone understands this, we made